Let us open again in Esther. We'll complete our reading here. We've reached verse 25 of chapter 9. We'll read from verse 26 through to the end of the book. And then we'll dwell upon it for a little while and reflect and see how God would teach us from it. So Esther chapter 9 at verse 26. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter, and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants, and all who would join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept through every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, with words of peace and truth, to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might, and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people, and speaking peace to all his countrymen. So far. As I say, let us dwell on these two chapters in the closing of this book. Very stylistic opening to the chapter in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day. The time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. Now is the day. The tale has gone quiet for just over 8 months between chapter 8 verse 17 and chapter 9 verse 1. The tale has gone quiet, but events are unlikely to have been quiet for the Jews or even their enemies. Think of the 8 months leading up to the Scottish independence referendum. There's been a lot said, a lot thought, a lot of discussion. Well, this is nothing like the Scottish referendum. It's a matter of life and death for an entire nation. And the day comes, the day to obey the king's command. Just by the way, do you notice that it says the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed in the singular? Command, singular, decree, singular. But there were two decrees, there were two commands had gone out. And just a little point that reminds us, as James puts it, he says, concerning God's command and decree, he says, whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he is guilty of all. There's a unity to the command of the king. How much more in God's case than it was in the case of Ahasuerus, where they conflicted. But it was, that day comes, those two commands stand. They are to be followed through. Therefore, because they are in tension, at least, conflict, how are things going to look at the end of this day? as you come to this book for the first time and you come to verse 1, now is the time. We've been hearing about this day, the 13th day of the 12th month. It's been in place for some time now. How are things going to look? Will there be no Jews left? How many Jews will be left? How many people will still go ahead and attack them? What will happen? Well, the story is told. You know the story. We've just read it. Let's just restate some of the key features here and consider what we need to learn through this chapter. The key features are, first of all, it becomes clear that there are still enemies all around them. We can also discover that they had a very effective self-defense set up. And the second part of the chapter talks about establishing the Feast of Purim. Enemies all around, effective self-defense, and establishing Purim. First of all, then, enemies all around. Remember where this came from. It was the idea of one man, Haman, who was in a very powerful position. He, the one man, was the person who wanted to get rid of Mordecai, and to do that, he would get rid of the entire Jewish people in every one of these 127 provinces. That was one man's idea. He had set things up that this should happen, Haman. But Haman was gone from the scene, dead, 8 months already. In place of Haman, Mordecai was running the country and running it well. What's going to happen today? Haman was the enemy of the Jews. He's gone. What will happen on the 13th day of the 12th month? The decree has gone out. The instruction has gone out throughout the empire. Is there anyone else who will follow through on the king's first decree? The fear of the Jews, we learn in chapter 8, verse 17, has fallen on many of the people of the land. But the people are faced with something of a dilemma now. One command of the king says, destroy all these Jews. The other command of the king says, the Jews can destroy you. You're almost caught between in a cleft stick. Which one are you going to disobey? Will you disobey the king because of the fear of the Jews, or will you face possible retaliation? The Jews are no longer defenseless. In the middle of that dilemma, which way will you go? With that in mind, it will take, therefore, a personal hatred, as it was with Haman. Personal hatred. It's the words that are used at the end of verse 1. The Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. That's the description. It's those who had this personal hatred who were going to follow through on the king's first command. It would take that for someone to then go ahead and attack the Jews. It would mean that they had a personal animosity to the Jews, or a Jew, perhaps, in their proximity. It would mean, as it was put also in verse 1, it would mean that there were some who had hoped to overpower the Jews. There was a hope, there was a hatred still in the minds of some. And it tells us that not only was Haman an enemy, but again in the middle of verse 1, that introductory verse, on the day that the enemies of the Jews, there was more than one. And it becomes evident at this point, although many others had a fear of the Jews. Haman wasn't alone in this great empire. There were enough who had enough motivation, at least so they thought, to persist, to go ahead with the opportunity that Haman had given them. Now, Haman was a dreadfully evil man, I think we might agree. from what is painted in this book. But there are other lesser evils, though he was taken away. There are others who still were set in their minds to oppose God's people. And we're given an idea of the scale of this. We'll come back in just a moment to the fact that the people that the Jews killed, they only did that in self-defense. But we learn of those that they did kill, it tells us that in Shushan, verse 6, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also those wonderful names of the 10 sons of Haman. They were still alive at this point, until this point. They killed these men who had clearly then attacked them. These were their enemies. And Haman's sons perhaps trying to recover what had been taken from their father on his execution. And then that was on the first day. But we remember that also there was also the provision that from verse 13 onwards that the Jews would be able to do the same again in Shushan. I'll come to that again in just a moment as well. But on that 14th day, it tells us that there are further 300 who were killed. So there's 800 so far, plus the 10 sons of Haman. Perhaps Shushan is especially mentioned, and perhaps there was a particularly intense struggle in this place. Perhaps it's because of that that there was an extra day given to it, because this was the citadel, this was the people who were closest to the king, perhaps a particular coterie who were around Haman himself, those who were pushing for power plays in society. Maybe that's the particular focus on the center. But then it also tells us further on that in verse 16, that in the rest of the provinces there were further 75,000 of their enemies who were killed by the Jews in self-defense. Maybe just a moment about the 2 days in Shushan as well. Again, it's not clear quite why this is. Why does Esther go beyond the original decree for self-defense? Well, for one thing, the result tells us that there were people in Shushan who were set themselves up to attack the Jews again the next day. They were still in self-defense mode, and there were 300 that they had to kill in response. I wonder if it is a very astute insight on Esther's part, or Mordecai, perhaps other advisors. There's one day of conflict. Would the Jews just rest the next day? What a great time to attack them again. Even though it wasn't sanctioned, yet there were perhaps those who were plotting on that account. The Jews would rest. They were not permitted to self-defense that time. It reminds me of the times when, you know, you see, as you're coming up to a speed camera, and you see all the brake lights flashing. Somebody's slowing down. And then, what happens past the camera, the lines on the road? Cars, he's away again. Don't you think it would be quite clever for a police to put a speed camera just around the bend? That's what's happened here. We've got through this moment. They'll be taking it easy. They'll be relaxed. They won't be taking any notice. We can get them again the next day. There's, I think, a very astute insight there that the provision was made to protect themselves once more. And those who had a hatred for them, those who wanted to overthrow them, were again defeated. Now, many have looked at the numbers like this, 75,000. It is a round number. The hundreds are also round numbers. It's almost, not far short of 76,000 people altogether. Some have called it carnage. I would suggest that the Jewish population through the provinces was far bigger than this. If they had been given a free hand to destroy the Jews, it would have been far greater number. 75,127 provinces averages out at 590 for each province. take even Judea as a province, and at this point it was quite sparsely populated with 42,000 people who had returned some years before this. 590 out of 42,000 is 1.4% of the population. Now, no single life should be dismissed, but the relative damage that was done, the relative casualties, is quite small. And we come to recognize, too, that the approach the Jews had was purely self-defense. Every one of these who died had set themselves up as an enemy of God's people, or they would not have been in a situation to be killed. There are a number of references that we'll see in just a moment that remind us the Jews only acted in self-defense, in no other way. It was not, you might say, disproportionate to the attack against them. Every one of these men acted as an enemy of the Jews. Enemies all around. And then there was the effective self-defense. In this chapter, we have no record whatsoever of deaths of Jews. What we do have is, in verse 1, that the Jews overpowered those who hated them. Perhaps they were, but it's not recorded. It tells us that it is an effective self-defense. In verse 16, it tells us that the Jews, in the middle of the verse, had rest from their enemies. It was complete. They were not going to be attacked again. As I said a moment ago about this idea that 75,000 was disproportionate, carnage. Why did they kill anyone at all? Only because of that first command that let their enemies attack them. But see what happens. The permission that was given to them in chapter 8 and verse 11 was this: to gather together and protect their lives. To do this by destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. You see the parts to this. First, they were to protect their lives. The gathering together was to improve their chances to do that. Not one man caught out alone. To protect their lives. Also, second, to destroy, kill, and annihilate. And it says it is those who are against them and their little children and women. Exactly the terms that were leveled against the Jews by Haman. And the third element was that they could plunder their possessions. This was restricted to the forces of any people or province that would assault them. That was a restriction. Others were going to be taking initiative, starting the quarrel. And so what did the Jews do with these directions? Well, it's summed up in verse 5 that they did what they pleased with those who hated them. What did they please to do? They killed the men. It's only men who are named as in the numbering. And given that the first decree says women and children, the second decree says women and children, and there is no record in these numbers of women and children, it's rather strange if they had killed any. The decrees explicitly mentioned the innocents, as they're called. Explicitly said, destroy them. But they are not included once in these numbers. It very strongly suggests that it was only the men who attacked them who were then killed. And the further part is that three times in the first half of the chapter, in verse 10, in verse 15, and verse 16, it says they did not lay a hand on the plunder. They didn't touch. They had every permission to take everything that belonged to those who attacked them. Haman's property was all given over to the king, and he passed it on to Esther, but the Jews themselves with all that permission, did nothing to take it. It reminds me of the story of Abraham, or Abram as he still was then, in Genesis 14. Lot had been taken by enemies with the rest of Sodom, and Abraham raised his men, 300 plus men, and went out after them, recovered them, defeated the other kings, and recovered all the people and their possessions. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, just let me have the people, you can have all the goods, you can have everything. And it was Abram's answer that is intriguing. He said to the king of Sodom, I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. And while the Egyptians threw possessions and stuff at the Israelites as they left Egypt, as they were rescued, you don't see any pattern of the Jews taking such as this. They did not plunder, though they were given a free hand to do it. It was an effective self-defense and nothing more. They restricted themselves very, very carefully to what was appropriate, a different spirit, rather than going with a free hand. And so it is that the day was a good one for the Jews. It had not been guaranteed at all, but we know it was good because they rested, verse 17, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. And that's the reason for the Feast of Purim. The establishing of Purim in the second part of the chapter from verse 18 onwards. The immediate next day, it was on the 13th day, and then in Shushan also on the 14th, but the day immediately following, the people celebrated with the repeated ideas of gladness and feasting. And in verse 19, sending presents to one another. When, a bit later on than this, Nehemiah asked Ezra to read the law in Jerusalem, and the people started to weep because they were grieved that they had sinned. And Nehemiah says, don't weep, rejoice, because the Lord has spoken to you. And make a day of rejoicing and eating and drinking and sending portions. It's a characteristic of the celebrations to send portions, to send presents to one another. So this is what they did on the 14th day. And out of that, this was taken by Mordecai and Esther, who decreed that this, amongst the Jews, should be an annual celebration. Verse 21, that Mordecai wrote them and said that you should establish among them to celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar. And the explanation for that follows, summarizing all that's gone before this. Remembering it as a day when sorrow turned to joy and mourning turned to a holiday for them. In our New Testament day, this is a pattern for the Lord's Day, Sunday. Friday was a day of mourning. Sunday was a day of life and joy. Sunday is a celebration day every week, not just once a year. But on this day, the day that was decided by the casting of lots, the Pur, and so it gets that name simply from that, the lots, the plural of Pur, Purim. The dice, you might say, although it was something different from dice as we know it. That day had been picked, selected, the understanding being that this was as Haman did it, that this would be by the gods their auspicious omens that pointed to this being a good day to do it. How much the Jews translated that into the Lord's overruling, we don't know. But it was seen to be a day that was worth celebrating. And so it was, verse 27, that the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants and all who should join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year. I actually find that quite a remarkable statement, that they imposed it on themselves and their descendants, that without fail they should celebrate. In some respects there's nothing wrong with that, provided everyone's in agreement. In the New Testament, Paul writes about saying taking Sabbaths and holy days, and says, but don't impose them. If you wish to celebrate them or mark them in some way, you're free to do so, but they're not to be imposed on anyone else. But here, the people take them and they impose it on themselves and their descendants. How important it is that they should never come to think of it as God's imposition. The terms of verse 31 are quite striking. It refers to it in slightly different words. It talks about the confirming these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai and Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants. But it's not quite as simple as that, because it is actually making a reference to something other than this, that there were other things that they had been doing that they had decreed for themselves and their descendants. This day, Purim, was about feasting and celebrating. But they had clearly, in verse 31, also, some other way, they had established, decreed for themselves to mark fasting and lamenting. So there's something else going on here. And there's a reference to that in Zechariah chapter 7, where the people came to Zechariah, they were back in the land, and they came to the prophet and said, should we carry on with these fasts? They were fasts to mark the destruction of the temple, for example. And they had chosen to mark them by fasting and lamenting. And the Lord speaks through Zechariah and says, well, ask yourself this question. If you want to know whether to carry on with that, ask yourself this question. Who are you doing it for? Have you not been doing it for yourselves all this time, and not for me? And the connection here, I think, is perhaps incidental, perhaps unwitting. But the same matter arises. When you're going to celebrate Purim, who are you doing it for? Will you do it to God, for Him? And as I read about the observance of the Jewish festivals through the years, through the centuries, it's not that I've made a close study, but bit by bit, I'm getting something of an impression that this is the one that is best kept. I'm not surprised if that is the case. Wouldn't be surprised at all. It's a celebration of a remarkable escape, from turning to sorrow to joy, and it seems fair enough to celebrate it. But remember, it is self-imposed. Who is it for? What about the ones that God had ordained for them? The great feasts of the Old Testament? Passover? Feast of Tabernacles? Day of Atonement? This was the question in Zechariah 7. You have been observing those. When you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months during those 70 years, did you really fast for me? For me? When you eat and when you drink, do you not eat and drink for yourselves? Should you not have obeyed the words which the Lord proclaimed through the former prophets, when Jerusalem and the cities around it were inhabited and prosperous, and the south and the lowland were inhabited? When things God was blessing you, how did you respond? What about those that God has ordained? I think you are wise enough, sharp enough, to realize how these things also raise questions for ourselves. Paul, I mentioned to him a moment ago that there are religious observances that we can believe that we should hold to. Paul warned about not imposing them on others. But these are raising the questions about why we're doing them. If it was possible to be absolutely certain that in this celebration they were freely acknowledging that God had done this work, God has saved us, God has delivered us, that would make it all the better. What about ourselves? When God grants us so many blessings, I might almost say, feel free to impose something on yourself to ensure that you celebrate, that you rejoice, that you give thanks. But remember what it's for. I'm not concluding my series on Esther just at the moment. If God gives us the days of the calendar that are in front of us, and I would hope to draw further out of some of these things relating to our own lives within the New Testament age. But this is a question that we should be asking ourselves, that we should be dwelling upon. The book doesn't tell us that they prayed and they gathered together to thank God for his deliverance. On the other side, the matters of fasting and lamenting. God was asking the people, in all of this, are you grieving at the loss of the city? Why are you not grieving that you've lost touch with me? And you did long before the city was destroyed. There are many ways in which we too might go through and forget and neglect the things that God has given us to mark, to celebrate, even to lament. The book closes with a brief account of Mordecai's great successes. He seems to have lived and worked with character. He tells us that he was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren because he was seeking their good, seeking peace. He was taking advantage of his position, and I don't mean that in a bad way, quite neutral. He was taking advantage of it for the sake of his own people, much maligned people. Perhaps still those who had an underlying animosity towards them. It tells us that these things, the works that he did, and the matters, the decree of Esther, these were written in the book, in the books, the accounts, where are the books? Well, they haven't been found yet. The books are perishable. But the feast lingers. It's still there. It bears witness to these things. The feast is pointless without this account, which is certainly an important part of why it is here, because the feast was such a big part, has been such a big part of the Jewish life. But it also sets before us, therefore, a number of questions dealing with God's providence, dealing with the problem of evil against God's people, dealing with matters of God's salvation, deliverance. Some of these I do want to come back to as we are having painted out the shape of the book. Dig it just a bit further, a bit deeper perhaps in some of these areas. But there we have the story so far. It's a very stirring story. It's got quite a rollicking plot. It goes up and down. It twists around. There are so many coincidences. There's evil, there's good. There's the power of men, there's the rapid rise and fall of men. And God's covenant people remain safe a little bit longer. How is that? The book tells us on the surface, why is that? Not sure the book does tell us, but it is there, set there in front of us for us to reflect upon. God's covenant people stay safe that little while longer. The cords of death entangle them. They're encircled by the snares of death. They face the terrors of the grave. The psalmist called on the Lord in his distress. But even if these people, Esther and Mordecai, we don't know that they called on the Lord, if they didn't. But yet the Lord holds to his great covenant that he promised to their father, Abraham. And for this evening, and just so far, let us close there and seek God to bless his word to us. Let us pray together.